Buenas tardes. Good afternoon. How's everyone doing? Well, let's try that one more time. How's everybody doing? There we go. There's the Europe I know. Thank you very much. It's a true pleasure and an honor to be here in Spain and Madrid for TechEd Europe. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a program manager in the Windows Server and Cloud Division. We've got a lot to talk about, so I'm going to jump right into it. Introduction to Windows Server 2012 R2. Let me first start off with a huge disclaimer. There is no way on earth I could even begin to cover everything new in Server 2012 R2 in, let alone 2 hours, let alone half a day. This is another major release. So today, we're going to be going a very quick flyover of a whole bunch of capabilities, but I'm so glad you're here because there's going to be plenty to see this week in terms of Windows Server, in terms of System Center, in terms of the capabilities we're bringing in terms of cloud. A couple of things I want to point out, as really quickly as folks are still kind of cycling in, is the momentum we've had around Windows Server 2012 and System Center 2012. It has honestly been amazing how quickly people have been jumping on Windows Server. We've seen it. For example, I know that literally the day after we released the bits, we had customers deploying 64-node Hyper-V clusters in production. They couldn't wait. So we're seeing it. We're seeing very quick adoption. We're very excited about that. A couple of comments here. We decided to avoid paying VMware $1.75 million in licenses and go with Windows Server to build a private cloud for our data centers. Forrester, a well-known analyst, said perceived notions about Microsoft versus VMware for the virtualization layer need to be reexamined. CRN, we won the Technical Innovator and Enterprise Application Award for Server 2012 for virtualization. Also IDC, Al Gillen, considered one of the preeminent analysts for virtualization in the world, basically said Server 2012 is built deep in the cloud. You end up with a solution that has the capability of doing the kinds of compute scenarios that customers will want to do the next few years. We think it's a great product. So there's a tremendous amount going on. Also today we announced world record. Honestly, I've known about this, was in the works for quite a while because I had the pleasure of working with SAP throughout the development of Windows Server 2012. In fact, a little inside baseball, as we'd like to say, I spoke with SAP's architects before we even began development of Server 2012, and we sat down and said very clearly, what is it you need to make sure that SAP has the absolute best platform? I want to know all of your requirements. Compute, storage, networking, memory, IOPS, you name it. You tell exactly what you need for SAP to run like a Ferrari on Hyper-V. They gave us that list, and then we exceeded all of those expectations. That was our goal from day one. And now I'm proud to say here, guess what? We've got a world record on a standard two-socket mainstream server. An SAP three-tier configuration, SQL Server, SAP, and quite simply, they supported Server 2012 on Hyper-V very quickly after we RTM'd Windows Server 2012, because they've known it, they've seen it, the performance is fantastic. In addition, we also made the huge announcement about the Microsoft-Oracle partnership. In fact, after the last foundation session I was in, a gentleman stopped by and just wanted to shake my hand and say thank you, and I said, explain why. And he said, look, I know technically in the past it may not have been supported, but I've been running Oracle on Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V, and it's just flat out unbelievably fast. It's exactly what we needed, but now we've got the support in place. Now we are literally going to deploy this thing everywhere, because that was the one thing that we needed to have to go out into large-scale deployment with confidence. So we're very excited about this partnership. So one of the things I'm going to do, you're probably going to see this slide perhaps throughout the week, and I hope you do. In fact, I hope you go back after this week and tell your friends that you're sick and tired of this slide, because it means we've actually got our message across. I want to be very clear about the Microsoft Cloud OS vision. Brad talked about it a little bit in the keynote. I've been in a couple of sessions. I'm going to go dig deep and very clearly understand what I mean by the Microsoft Cloud OS. First of all, we think about the Microsoft Cloud OS vision as literally three legs to a stool. All right? Very simply, it starts with the private cloud. And the reason why is because historically, this is where it started out from. Let me explain to you what happened here. In the 90s, the answer to every problem seemed like just go buy another server. Servers are inexpensive. They're easy to set up. In fact, even in the first part of the 2000s, aught years, people were still buying servers at a very fast rate. People would come to Microsoft. I would chat with them. They say, Jeff, look, I have no problem buying as many servers as I need. I can easily justify the budget. But then around 2004, 2005, 2006, the conversation changed. Customers said, Jeff, I still have the budget. I can still buy as many servers as I need. I have no place to put them, and I have no power to power them with. That's my problem. So virtualization arose as a way to solve this problem for consolidation. So we took 5, 10 servers, and we virtualized them and put them on a single physical server. Okay? Now, that's great. That's virtualization for consolidation. That is not cloud. The other guys have been selling this and trying to state this as cloud. That's wrong. I reject it completely. Okay, here's the difference. We took those physical machines, we virtualized, we put them on the same server. But how did we manage them? You see, the management paradigm never changed. I still log into VM number 1 or VM number 2 or VM number 3, and I manage them individually. I change an IP address or change a memory or storage or networking resources, but I manage them individually. Again, there's nothing wrong with this, but this is virtualization for consolidation. This is not cloud. When I think about cloud, I think about deploying services. I don't think about deploying a VM or a server. I want to deploy a service that's multiple virtual machines. And I want to define this and say, it gets this much memory, it gets this much storage, and if it needs to grow, it will grow elastically. It will shrink elastically. Cloud is about availability. Cloud is about it's usage base. Cloud is requestable. And none of these words did I say virtualization. Cloud is all of these different aspects and much more. Now, the reason why it started on premises is with private cloud, it's about control. Quite simply, folks said, look, I want to be able to run this on my premises. In fact, I run into this all the time still. I talk with folks in Germany or in Canada, and they say, Jeff, Azure looks fantastic. I love it. However, I have workloads that have to run in a Canadian data center on Canadian soil by a Canadian citizen. So no matter how cool you tell me Azure is, I'm always going to run it on premises. So are we going to argue about this? Absolutely not. This is not a technical conversation in any way, shape, or form. This is a business conversation. And you know what? We want to make sure that you have the best private cloud out there. So let's help you do that together. So private cloud is about control. Then we have the public cloud. The public cloud is where we have literally spent billions of dollars of investment. With Windows Azure, we have platform as a service. With Office 365, we have software as a service. With Azure Virtual Machines, we have true infrastructure as a service. With the public cloud, you get massive scale. I can create, with an MSDN account, I can create a service, I can create an application, an Azure service, deploy it up there, and start it off in North America and deploy it in Europe, deploy it in Asia Pacific, deploy it around the world, and if it needs to grow, it just automatically grows. That's what I get from Azure. I get scale. Then also we have service providers. Service providers give us reach. They give us customization. I talk to customers that say, you know, Jeff, I work with a service provider. We have a great relationship. We've worked with them for many years, and I want to keep that relationship. Fantastic. We completely agree. That's why we think all of these are very important. That service provider, you may have custom terms with. Maybe they put your specific servers in a specific rack. Or maybe you have specific customized requirements that you want. Great. They can give that to you. At the scale we do Azure, we just can't do that. But the important thing to understand is it's all three of these. It's one consistent platform. And by the way, did you notice I just brought up the Windows Azure Pack? See, the Windows Azure Pack fits in here exactly like a glove. Because we want to make sure whether you're on-premises building and managing your own private cloud, or you're up in Azure, or you're with a service provider, it's a consistent look and feel. It's a consistent interface. One of the big challenges we hear right now is, hey, I go to AWS, it looks one way. I go to Salesforce, it looks another way. I go to Azure, it looks another way. I go here, or here, or here. Oh, by the way, then my internal cloud looks totally different. And I have to train my users every time I have one of these different cloud interfaces. We're giving you the code. That's what the Azure Pack is all about. It's about giving you that consistency, and guess what? You own it. You control it. It's on your premises. And we're going to deliver more services to you to run on premises. But it's this one consistent platform. And also, it's about having the development tools to be able to do this wherever those services run, whether it's on-premises, in a service provider, or in the public cloud. It's about management, system center, and providing consistent management across all of these. And it's not just the virtual machines. I've seen this mistake made for over 10 years now. People come in and tell me, oh, I'm running all these VMs and everything's great. I'm like, great, how are you managing the apps? And they're like, well, I'm managing the VMs. That's not managing the apps. At the end of the day, I don't care if Exchange is running in physical or if Exchange is running in virtual. I care that Exchange is running well. Let us set up System Center and actually monitor your infrastructure, and lo and behold, we're going to probably be able to quickly help you out and sort out a whole bunch of performance issues you may not even know you have. So management is key. Being able to data. You notice I've got SQL Server now. We've got SQL with on-premises. We've got SQL Server service providers. We've got SQL Server in Azure, both as infrastructure as a service virtual machines or as the true native Azure services, SQL Server, SQL Azure services. So we've got big data everywhere. We've got identity. As you heard Brad mention in the keynote this morning, your foundational canonical identification is Active Directory. You've got it today on premises, your service providers have it, and guess what? Azure Active Directory is all there running right now. So you can easily federate, and you mentioned it earlier in the keynote, we have nearly 500,000 different organizations are federating with Azure Active Directory already. And then finally, virtualization. And again, this is different from the other guys. The other guys think virtualization is the center of the universe, and they couldn't be more wrong. Virtualization is a facet of cloud. But you can see that is the difference. We look at the cloud very holistically, because at the end of the day, what you want to do is you want to lower your costs. You want to make it easy for your consumers to use. You want to make money. And most importantly, you want to be agile. We've been doing IT and data centers for the longest time, for the last many decades. It's time for something new. It's time for something different. It's time for something more cost-effective, and we all want to do it faster. That's what our Cloud OS vision is all about. So before I get into 2012 R2, I want to quickly fly through and remind everyone what we delivered in 2012, because quite honestly, we delivered a lot. And I know a lot of people are still trying to grok all of the changes we made in 2012. First of all, let's just start off with the raw scale numbers. Best in class in the industry, bar none. Period. Full stop. You're looking for the biggest, baddest virtual machines, the biggest, baddest clusters, the biggest, baddest physical server support. It's right here. It's called Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. We support up to 320 logical processors per server. That's a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores and you enable symmetric multithreading. We support the largest physical memory in the industry. That's 4 terabytes. That's two times the other guys. We support up to 2,048 virtual procs per host. And look at this one. We support up to 1 terabyte of memory, 64 virtual procs, and up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. Think about that for just a moment. Not per virtual machine, per virtual disk. That's 32 times anyone else in the industry. You want big data? You want to be able to run big analytics? You know, years ago, 2 terabytes, everyone said, that's huge for a virtual machine. I'll never need that. Oh, no, we've been hearing people really need it. We've actually had a lot of people very excited because 64 terabytes gives them plenty of headroom for growth. And then, of course, you can see at the bottom, we support the largest clusters in the industry, up to 64 nodes and 8,000 virtual machines in a cluster. Both of those numbers are actually very important. Our large enterprises and cloud service providers said, we need both. Okay? So one question I get asked all the time is, hey, Jeff, do I have to have 64 nodes to go up to 8,000 VMs? Well, technically, no. We support up to 1,024 VMs per host, so technically you could create an 8-node cluster and run 8,000 VMs. Now, would I recommend that? Definitely not. Your fault domain's way too high. That's why that second number is so important, 64 nodes. Because with 64 nodes, that means that's 125 virtual machines per node. And just to give you some idea, back at MMS a few months ago, we actually had a 32-node cluster running all of our MMS labs, and we ran over 8,300 VMs on it, ran flawlessly. So we know this scales really, really well, best-in-class numbers here. In addition, when it comes to performance, we've also had third parties verify our performance. With Server 2012, you can see nearly perfectly linear performance within the VM. You can see we've added 4, 8 virtual processors, 16, all the way up to 64 virtual processors. And this is an OLTP workload. This is a big, bad SQL. This is industry standard performance benchmark. And you can see nearly perfect linear scalability. You won't find this on any other hypervisor. SQL runs just tremendously awesome in Hyper-V 2012. And this is due to work that we've done inside the virtual machine, such as, for example, for the first time doing guest NUMA and providing NUMA topology within the virtual machine. In addition, we've also done performance work with Exchange. Now, the first thing I'm going to say right off the bat is this is not a deployment recommendation. The point here was to show just Hyper-V scalability. This is actually running 48,000 mailboxes on a single server. Now, if you're an Exchange DB, an Exchange admin, you know that Exchange is about scale out. So I'm not telling you to go put all your mailboxes on a single server. The point here is we wanted to show that as we added more mailboxes, we actually got up to 48,000 VMs, and we still maintained Exchange's requirement for staying below 20 milliseconds in terms of response time. That shows just how awesome our performance is with Hyper-V. And then in 2012, we demonstrated over 1 million IOPS from a single virtual machine. Now, if you saw me in the keynote this morning, I let out the surprise this morning, which was this was last year. This was Tech Ed Amsterdam last year where we did this demonstration publicly, and I showed over 1 million IOPS, and this was 4K IOPS. The one I showed you this morning was 1.6 million IOPS, and it was the much harder 8K IOPS, which aligns perfectly with what SQL and Exchange are looking for from an IO perspective. So with 2012 R2, we're delivering you a 60% performance improvement and delivering twice the amount of data, and you're seeing just tremendous performance. Good luck for the other guys trying to catch up with this in terms of performance, by the way. So in terms of storage, we made huge investments in 2012. Live storage migration, the new VHDX format. This is just tremendous, especially if you own a SAN, because it will auto-align with your SAN. If you've ever had any sort of alignment issues in the past with the VHD format, those are completely gone now. You just deploy VHDX, and we will auto-align with your SAN. It just works. We support 4K disks. By the way, we are the only hypervisor in the industry that I'm aware of right now that actually supports native 4K disks. And as they come to market very soon, we're ready to support them right now. The other guys will very likely charge you for an upgrade to get that support. We support it right now. In addition, we introduced virtual fiber channel. So it's a real virtual fiber channel HBA in the VM. We don't do some crazy hack and try and present a raw disk in your VM and call it a fiber channel one. No, this is a real, honest-to-goodness fiber channel adapter. This means all of those things that are important to you, like multipath I/O, guest clustering, all works flawlessly in a Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V VM. Also offloaded data transfer to take advantage of your SAN capabilities and dramatically increase your SANs. Automatic trim unmap, and of course the big one, support for the scale-out file server with SMB3. So as you saw me do some demos today, I show you kind of some of the interesting things about this, the scale-out file server performance and tiering and deduplication. I'll get to more of that in a minute. But that's based on these investments we made in Windows Server 2012. And let me be very frank for just a moment. If you're getting ready to buy storage, you need to absolutely tell your storage vendor, I don't want to see anything that doesn't have SMB3 support. That should be an absolute must. You say, I'd like to see your SMB3 storage support, please. Because if you don't, you're going to be very unhappy if you do something that's based on the older SMB2 or, heaven forbid, even SMB1. And I'm shocked at how much SMB1 is still shipping today. You go out and buy one of those little NAS appliances that they claim is really cool. It's using a 25-year-old SMB 1.0 protocol. The performance is terrible. SMB3 is awesome. Multi-channel gets you resiliency, gives you better performance, better scale, better performance, and encryption, as well as SMB scale-out, all taken care of in the scale-out file server. In terms of networking, network virtualization. We provide open, extensible virtual switch, advanced capabilities, Windows NIC teaming. I got to say, Windows Server 2012 NIC teaming is simply awesome. Since we've shipped, I haven't had a single person come to me with a NIC teaming problem anymore. Everyone just says, nope, we've just deployed Server 2012 NIC teaming and everything just works. Just simply works. We love that. And in fact, we even tweaked a little bit more in R2 to make it even better. Network quality of service, all included in the box. Network metering, DVMQ, SRIOV for those scale-up workloads where you require more than 10 gigabits into a virtual machine. So for example, if you are running that scale-up SAP, that scale-up SQL, that scale-up Oracle, and you need more than 10 gigabits, you know, you're used to having two 10 gigabit NICs to that workload. Guess what? With SRIOV, you get that, and it works with live migration. We're the only hypervisor that gives you SRIOV and live migration together. And then when it comes to VM mobility, quite simply, we raise the bar completely when it comes to VM mobility. Not only do we do live migration with HA, live migration on file-based storage, live storage migration, but we're the first hypervisor to introduce and ship shared nothing live migration, where I can literally live migrate between two systems with literally just a network connection. No clustering needed. No shared storage needed. Just networking. So you can see we have been hard at work. And again, this is everything we've already shipped. This has been shipping for over a year now. This is Server 2012 Hyper-V. And one of the things I like to point out is another thing that we also did was we also provided unlimited concurrent live migration. I'd like to see the other guys do this. Again, this is Server 2012. What you're seeing here is I'm actually live migrating 40 VMs simultaneously. Again, this is Server 2012. This isn't even all the goodness with R2 yet. This is actually two 10 gigabit NICs teamed, and we are live migrating them all. In the lower left-hand corner, you have to see this is done with PowerShell because we can't actually go through the UI fast enough. We actually have to do PowerShell to automate this and actually live migrate them all. So if you have two 1 gigabit NICs, yeah, maybe I can live migrate 2 to 4 of these. Maybe if I've got dual teamed 1 gigabit, maybe I can do, you know, 4 to 6. If I've got 10 gigabit, maybe I can do 10 to 20. If I've got dual team 10 gigabit, well, you're seeing 40. And by the way, if you've got quad team 10 gigabit, I've actually demonstrated over 200 VMs being live migrated simultaneously. And again, this is all what's shipping in 2012. In R2, when you add RDMA and live migration compression to it, it just gets simply ridiculous at this point. So let's get to it. That was your quick blow-by of everything that's shipping right now, right available, ready for you to deploy right now. The good news is we're going to make it easy for you. If you've already deployed 2012, we're going to make it easy for you to deploy on R2 as well, and I'll get to that. So when it comes to Server 2012 and System Center 2012, we have some top investment themes for us. We've been thinking about, well, quite literally, a data center without boundaries. We think, again, I'm going back to three parts, three legs of a stool analogy. We think about the cloud OS very holistically. We think about cloud innovation everywhere. It's not just the hypervisor. It's the storage stack. It's the network stack. It's automation. It's manageability. It's scalability. It's performance. It's security. We think about this in much greater terms. Dynamic application delivery, flexible and consistent application platform, enable people-centric IT. Again, I'm going to reiterate something I mentioned earlier. There is no way on earth I could even begin to cover all of the new things in Server 2012. For example, people-centric IT. There's a whole bunch of great sessions about that. Things like the remote desktop protocol, things that we've done enhancements to make RDP even more efficient, things that we've done about access anywhere on any devices. Take a look and check out those sessions while you're here. So let's start with data center without boundaries and pulling ahead in virtualization. So first of all, we think about integrated high-performance virtualization. And some of the things you've told us that you need is, number one, you want reduced complexity, cost, and downtime. Today, there's a tremendous amount of complexity. Private cloud, we want to take the really difficult and we want to make it really easy. Right now, setting up a cloud is too difficult. There's a lot of work that we can do. You've also told us you want to ease deployment and support lifecycle of workloads. Also, provide a flexible platform for maximum agility. So some of the things that we're doing, just a few of those things in response, are cross-version live migration. So if you've already deployed Server 2012, and guess what? You want to go deploy Server 2012 R2, because you can take those virtual machines and simply drag and drop them, and it will live migrate from Server 2012 to 2012 R2. And if you're taking advantage of the new storage tiering deduplication, you just magically get that feature, because you just move the VM and your entire service to the new platform. online virtual disk resize, so we can now grow and shrink disks on the fly while the VM is running. Automatic VM activation, live VM export and cloning, remote access via VM bus, all sorts of great new capabilities to make it easier to deploy. Let me talk about VM activation for just a moment. This is actually something we want to make really easy, especially for service providers in large enterprises. For folks that run their business like a cloud service provider, you manage your infrastructure and you have your services that run on top. And very often they're going to have two different networks that don't talk to each other because the infrastructure is isolated on its own network. Well, it means when you have to go activate, it means KMS servers may not exactly line up. Not a problem. With automatic VM activation, if you're running server 2012 R2 in your guest, in your VM, and you're running it on the host, we'll actually look down to the host and go, oh, if you're running data center, we give you unlimited copies of Windows Server, so guess what? We'll automatically activate it for you. Don't have to deal with KMS. As long as your host is activated properly, your guest will be as well if they're running 2012 R2. And then in terms of agility, like I showed you in the demonstration in the keynote this morning, live migration with compression is simply awesome. I mean, it is. It just uses a little bit more CPU and dramatically, look, we've seen at least 2x performance. Many times it's faster than that. And then with RDMA, then it just becomes ludicrous speed. Okay, because now you're talking about DMA. Okay, there's no extra CPU utilization. In fact, we're hitting some interesting bottlenecks now. Using SMB Direct over RDMA is so fast, the speed of your RAM now matters. When's the last time that you've ever heard someone say that? We've seen live migration that, hey, if I'm using 1066 DIMMs versus, 1888 or whatever the faster DIMMs are, it makes a difference. It makes a difference if you're using PCIe 2 versus PCIe 3. That's how fast live migration is with SMB Direct and RDMA. It is ludicrously fast. We'll talk more about that. So with that, I'd like to bring up Ben Armstrong to give us a demo on Windows Server 2012 R2 Hyper-V. Ben?
So thanks very much. Am I on?
Yep.
First, I'm going to steal a little bit of Jeff's thunder and say, this is just a teaser for my session this afternoon. I will be here at 5 o'clock going in deep on everything that's new in Hyper-V. And you can actually see here I have a little demo script which I'm going to be using later today. It kicks off about 13 different demos, and I'm just going to show a couple of them here and talk through why we did them and what we've been hearing from customers. So the first one I'm going to kick off is the online resize that Jeff talked about just before. So this is going to go ahead and fire up a virtual machine that I can use to demonstrate this. Now, today, Windows Server 2012, if you're doing a private cloud or a hosted cloud deployment and you need to resize a virtual hard drive for any reason, you have to take the virtual machine off to do that. Now, this has been a big problem for people because a couple of things that we've heard is we've heard very common practice to say, you know what, my customers don't actually know how much space they need. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to provision a very small disk by default. You know, by default, I'm going to give people a 40 gig drive and then I'll wait and see. And if they need more, they can call up, they can ask for more. But that's required downtime. So you can see here, I have a virtual machine. I've got my data disk, currently 62 gigabytes. Now, 2012 R2, I can just come in here, find that virtual hard drive, I'm going to edit it, and choose to expand it. So I'll put this up to, let's say, 300 gig. Come into the guest. And there it is. I have the space. Now, a lot of people see this and they don't realize some functionality that's been in Windows forever, so I have to demonstrate this, that I can now come in here and straight away I can expand that disk and take advantage of that space. Fantastic, and zero downtime. Now, let's imagine for a moment that I'm a service provider and Jeff's my customer, and this is all fine and good. Jeff's asked for more space. I've given him more space. life's happy. He had zero downtime. As a service provider, I'm now charging him more for the data that he's using. Now, Jeff, you asked me to size this up to 300 gig.
Yep.
And a month later, you realized that you only needed 100 gig. How much are you paying for right now?
I'm paying for the 300.
And are you happy about that?
No, I want to be paying for the 100.
So you want to be paying for the 100. Well, we can actually do that online, too. A lot of people think that we're just doing expand, but I'm going to come in here first. So Jeff's realized he doesn't need this space. So he's going to come in here, and he's going to say, actually, let's shrink that volume, take it back down. Once again, all running. We've now got some free space in there, and he's going to call me up and say, hey, Ben, I know I asked for the extra space. I don't actually need it. I don't want to be paying for it. Can you please go ahead and reclaim the space that I'm not using anymore? So I can come in here, and now this time I'm going to select to shrink, and what you'll see is we've actually gone in and figured out, oh, he's got a partition that's using just over 100 gig, so you can shrink to 101 gig. So I'm going to do that, hit OK, go back in here, and now the space is gone. All done online, enabling very flexible, you know, configuration with zero downtime. So that's been a big ask. Really happy to see that coming out. So next thing I want to show is just a taste of some of the investments that we've been doing in Linux. So another big thing that we've heard is we've heard a lot of people going, hey, you know, we really love what's happening in Windows Server. You know, it's our primary platform, but we have applications where we need to support Linux. Now, to be clear, Microsoft does an amazing job of supporting Linux today. It supports Linux like you wouldn't expect Microsoft to support Linux. We have a lot of features, and all of our drivers and, you know, infrastructure are available as part of the Linux kernel under the GPL. In 2012 R2, we went the extra mile to try and make Linux a first-class citizen. So one of the features I'm going to demonstrate right now is dynamic memory support for Linux. Let me just arrange my screen a little so we can see exactly what's happening while I run this demo. So I have this Linux virtual machine. Unfortunately, there's a bug in the video driver. I get this nice little bar here. Let me just erase that. So what you can see is, if you have a look at the numbers down here, this virtual machine was configured with 1 gig of RAM. It started up. I haven't got anything running in there. So it's now gone down to, you know, around 700 meg of RAM. So that's dynamic memory coming in and ballooning the memory away. But what we did in 2012 R2 was not just dynamic memory support for ballooning, but we did the full dynamic memory support with the hot add as well. So I have a little program that I'm going to run here, very complicated program. What it does is every time I hit enter, it's going to allocate 150 meg of RAM. And if you watch the little numbers down here, you can see the memory demand and the memory assignment. And every time I hit enter, the demand's going to go up inside the virtual machine. We're going to assign memory. Now, I'm actually running my laptop kind of busy right now. So what we're going to see is about now, I'm actually out of memory on the laptop. So if you watch the assigned memory column closely, you'll see that when I hit enter, that not only do we give the Linux virtual machine some more memory, but we're taking away memory from my other virtual machines to make this happen. So there's my final. We're now up to around 1.5 gig, just over 1.5 gig of memory. Now I'm going to go ahead, free that memory, and almost immediately you're going to see there the memory demand's gone down, and we will take back memory from the Linux virtual machine and give it to the other virtual machines that need it. So the final thing I want to demonstrate in this session is the shared VHDX feature. So let me bring that up. This is actually, I think, one of the most exciting features in this release. I'm going to log into this virtual machine. And I'll bring up the cluster administration tools so that you can see that this virtual machine is actually a member of a cluster. So what I actually have is this virtual machine is a node in a scale-out file server. I have it configured with the scale-out file server role. I have a quorum disk, and I have a CSV volume configured as well. So if we just have a look, here's my scale-out file server role running, and here's my storage. So if you've set up clusters, you know, okay, that's all fairly typical. What's not typical is if I bring up the settings for this, you can see that actually my quorum disk and my CSV volume are virtual hard drives that are running on a different scale-out file server. So key thing here is we used to support this a long time ago, didn't we? We had virtual server allowed you to do clustering with virtual hard drives. However, what was the guidance we had?
Don't use it in production.
Don't use it in production. It was dev test only.
It was dev test.
And why did we have that?
Because it's all running on the same server.
All running on the same server. You have no real high availability.
It's not HA.
However, in this case, this isn't a dev test solution. This is a full production grade solution because those VHDs are actually stored on a scale-out file server themselves, and we're actually using the shared access semantics of that scale-out file server to ensure availability of the virtual machine. So this is all cool, and you may be thinking, hey, Ben, that's neat, nice demo, why do I care? Well, let's actually do a quick show of hands. How many people here have guest clusters in their environment today? They have a couple of virtual machines set up. So not many. Now, all you people who have it, and all you people who don't have it but have looked at it, will know that today, Server 2012, if you want to do a guest cluster, you had to set up special storage for that. You had to set up a separate iSCSI target. You had to use virtual fiber channel. You had to do something, and that was a pain. You had to go out of your way in order to configure it. Well, with 2012 R2, that's no longer the case. What you're going to do is you're going to take all your virtual machines, you're going to stick them either on a scale-out file server or a CSV volume, and you're going to use the same storage whether you're doing guest clustering or not. So now, when you have a user, whether it's an external customer or whether it's an internal customer, come to you and say, hey, I've got a workload that we're virtualizing that I really want to have that extra level of high availability. I need guest clustering. Your answer now is, fine, let me check that box for you. That's all the work. It's no longer, we're going to have to figure out what storage do we need to buy, how are we going to do that. It is now dead simple. If you come in, I'll show you where the checkbox is. Here it is, enable virtual hard disk sharing. That was the only difference. I checked the box. I can now do guest clustering with full availability. So I'm going to hand back to Jeff.
Awesome.
And once again, I will put out the pitch.
If you
want to learn about everything else that's happening in Hyper-V, you want to be in this room at 5 p.m.
Nice job.
Take it away.
Everyone, give a hand to Ben. So those are just a few of the things that are going on there in terms of Hyper-V. Let's switch on over to storage for just a second. You talked a little bit about the scale-out file server, talked a little bit about shared VHDX. I'm going to take a moment to talk about storage for just a moment. And there's a lot of interesting things I found out about storage over the years. A lot of people tend to treat their storage devices, whether it's a NAS or a SAN, almost with like this holy reverence. It's like you walk by it, but you don't actually look at it straight ahead. You don't want to make it angry because it holds all your data. And it's interesting to see kind of what's happened over the years with storage appliances and how they've kind of changed. And I wanted to take a moment to kind of demystify a storage appliance. So what do I mean by that? So, for example, today you go out and you buy a SAN or a NAS and you'll get a storage head. In fact, you'll probably get at least two. But if you look inside that storage head, you actually crack open the case and look inside, what will you find? Well, what you'll find in a modern storage appliance is you'll find a whole bunch of x86 processors, x64 processors. You'll find a whole bunch of memory. You'll find network adapters. You'll find storage HBIs, most likely SAS controllers. Sound familiar? Yeah, it sounds awful lot like a server to me. Let's take a closer look. So if you take a storage appliance and take the head and actually cut it in half, okay, just, logically, well, what does the front and the back half do? Well, the back half is where you have all those SAS controllers. Those actually plug into your physical disks. That's where you pull your disks. It presents LUNs. You do mirroring. You do RAID, et cetera, et cetera. The front part of your SAN or your NAS appliance presents interfaces, iSCSI, Fiber Channel, FCOE, NFS, SMB. And of course, you never buy one of these, you always buy two. And the reason why you buy two is because it's a scale-out server. And the reason why is because if one of these goes down, the other one picks right up automatically. If you have to do a firmware update, fine. You do the firmware update and you switch to the other one, and then you do the firmware and you switch back to the second one. And in fact, you can add more of these, and usually you can go up from 2 to 4. Some go as high as even 8. And then, of course, you attach your servers to these. And that can be over Ethernet, gigabit, 10 gigabit, or it can be over fiber channel, 1, 2, 4, 8, or even 16 gigabit fiber channel. So the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I want to explain to you what we're doing with the file server and spaces, because I get a lot of people asking me, what is spaces? I don't understand. I saw this really cool keynote demo where you did tiering and deduplication in spaces. What is that spaces thing? Well, let me show you. So again, there's the same exact picture. Look at the back. That's spaces. Think about that for a second. Spaces is where we take all of your physical disks, we pool them all together, and now with 2012 R2, we can also detect your hard disks and SSDs and create tiers out of them. The front, that's the file server. The file server is what presents your interfaces, iSCSI, NFS, SMB. And then your servers attached to it, how? Oh, and by the way, you notice it's clustered. This is really important. This is what we delivered in Server 2012. This is the continuously available, this is the scale-out file server. So you deploy 2 of these, or 3, or 4. In fact, you go all the way up to 8 if you'd like. Okay? But if you deploy at least 2, it means I can walk up to one of those, yank out the power cable, and the other one continues right along with no loss of transaction at all. No retries. It is completely fault-tolerant. Of course, your servers then attach either via Ethernet, gigabit or 10 gigabit, or even 40 or 56 gigabit, and even over RDMA. Now, you may be looking at that going, hold it, Jeff, 40 gigabit and 56, well, that's faster than fiber channel. Yes. Yes, it is. It's a lot faster. In fact, at a fraction of the cost. So this is what we delivered in 2012, and in fact, we're doubling down on that investment in 2012 R2. That's where tiering is going in spaces. The deduplication we do in the file server. And we're doing even more major investments in here. So, with that, this is what that Hyper-V and scale-out file server look like. You've got your Hyper-V compute nodes communicating via SMB to your scale-out file server. Your scale-out file server has spaces, which is, by the way, storage virtualization. That's essentially what spaces is. And then you have your block storage behind it. So if you're familiar with enterprise-grade capabilities, storage tiering, data deduplication, pooling of disks, HA, guess what? Oh, persistent write-back cache, copy offload snapshots. Guess what? We have that in the file server. Storage tiering, deduplication, resiliency options, pooling of disk, HA, write-back cache, SMB copy offload snapshots. Huh. Sounds awfully familiar. Well, we're making huge investments in here. I'm going to say it. I said it in my last session. I'm going to say it again. Every customer I have talked with ever has a storage problem. Everybody. Jeff, storage costs too much. Jeff, I don't have enough. Or Jeff, I actually have a whole bunch of storage, and I have a little bit of an iSCSI, I have a little bit of block, I have a little bit of file, I have a little bit of this. And guess what? It's completely all over the place, and I have no way to manage it all. And usually the answer is all 3, by the way. We're looking at this very carefully, and we want to help solve this. Okay, we're making huge investments in storage management, in SMIS. We're making huge investments in the file server, in tiering, in deduplication. We're going to continue to drive down the complexity and drive down the cost of storage because, as you have told us so many times, this is way too difficult and it costs way too much. Tiering, like I said, in the box now. If you saw me in the keynote this morning, it blows my mind even there to do the demo, to see it go from 7,400 IOPS to go to over 124,000 IOPS just by using a couple of SSDs. This to me is like magic in a bottle. I've been waiting for SSDs for a very, very long time. We have long been held hostage to the fact that a hard drive has a rotating platter and a little read-write head that goes across there. Go back to 1955. Look at the very first disks that IBM created. Guess what? They look the same, except they were really huge. Okay? They had seek times of seconds, but it was still this huge monster platter turning with a read write head. Yeah, it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, but we still had to deal with a read write head. SSD gets rid of that problem completely. Okay? Your typical 15K SAS drive gives you anywhere between 150 to 200 IOPS per disk. This SSD gets me 30 to 50,000 IOPS per disk. There is a storage revolution going on, and SSD is going to make make our lives a lot better. That's why we're making huge investments in storage tiering in Windows Server 2012 and in R2. So with that, I'd like to invite Matt McSpirit on stage to do a demonstration of what we're doing in terms of storage. Matt.
There we go. Excellent. Thank you. Good afternoon. Now, Jeff's done a great job talking about some of the key capabilities around storage, and he flashed up a great graphic that showed us just what the scale-out file server would look like. Hyper-V host connecting to some compute nodes, connecting to some shared JBOD storage. But to build that, what kind of process would we have to go through? We'd have to image some servers with Windows Server 2012 R2, turn on the file services role and features, configure it as a cluster, attach it obviously to our shared JBOD storage as well, and that's going to take a little bit of time. Now I can do that, and it's fairly easy, but there's a better way, and there's a simpler way. And I'm going to actually deploy a clustered file server using System Center 2012 Virtual Machine Manager, 2012 R2 specifically. So within the storage view in my fabric view here in VMM, I'm going to quickly create a file server cluster. So I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to name this one after Ben. There we go. Ben scale out file server. There you go, Ben. Don't say I don't do anything for you. And then we've got a choice. We've got a first choice we need to make. How am I going to get this scale-out file server provisioned? Are there some Windows Server 2012 R2 machines already there that aren't doing anything that I could turn on the file services role and features and transform it into a file server cluster? That's one way. But I'm actually going to provision some bare metal servers that are literally racked, they're connected to our JBOD, and they're on the network, so I can communicate with them. And I'm going to choose a particular file server profile that's going to standardize how I deploy that file server. So each one I deploy is the same as the next one. So it's configured optimally in a scalable way. So I'm going to go next. I'm going to specify some baseboard control credentials. And that's going to allow me to communicate out of band with those physical servers that are currently in an off state. And I need to be able to discover them. So I'm going to find them on the network. 141, and I'm going to find them in this particular range. We'll go next, and it'll search, and it'll find the two servers that I'm looking for. Remember, these are completely off. There's no operating system on them in this case. And I'm going to skip something called deep discovery, because that would boot the machine into a WinPE environment, capture some metrics and some information about it, and return it to the next step of this wizard. I don't need that to continue, but it would help me populate this kind of wizard with a bit more information about CPU, cores, memory, current disk config, and so on. But I'm just going to go the simple route and give it a name, give the next server a name, and if there was lots of them in here, it's just a case of me adding the appropriate names and clicking next. And within a couple of clicks, and I can see the PowerShell behind the scenes that's going to execute for me to do that if I want to automate this more flexibly going forward, but in a few clicks, I've actually ready to deploy now a clustered file server. VMM is going to build that whole scale-out file server. It's going to get it completely ready for our consumption. And now I've got one I've made earlier, because that will take a little bit of time to actually build. And in my file servers view, I've got my scale-out file server that's currently a two-node configuration, same as what I was just about to build. But if I needed to scale that out, hence the name scale-out file server, then I can scale out the compute nodes by just coming into this wizard and adding the fully qualified domain name or alternative IP address of the new node that I want to bring into this file, a scale-out file server. And VMM will orchestrate the rest. In addition, if I want to scale out the capacity of the pool from a storage perspective, I simply manage the pools, the groups of disks that Jeff was talking about earlier. In this case, this particular pool, if I look at the properties by editing, you'll see it's already got a number of disks, and I just need to click the extra disks that I want to add to this pool. Maybe they've been hot added to the storage array, the JBOD set of disks that we've got available. And I click confirm, and that's done. I expand out my capacity. But one thing to note is this thin provisioning alert, because that is very, very important. The thin provisioning alert allows me to say, okay, I'm thin provisioning my spaces from my pool, and they're filling up. I don't want to go over capacity of what I actually physically have. So that thin provisioning alert is going to alert me if I'm getting close, or in this case, past 70%. If I'm using System Center, like Operations Manager, the alert's going to coincide in there as well. So I can see and get visibility into what's going on. So I'll cancel out of there. I'm ready to now deploy a file share, to some Hyper-V hosts. Otherwise, this share isn't accessible to any servers. So I go into one of my host groups, and I choose a server that I'm interested in. And in this case, in fact, let me go back. In this case, I first need to create my file share, a new one. I've got plenty already, but I'll create one that's fresh so we can see. I'll create this one for Ben as well. Tier 1 storage, he requires the best, and we'll give him 20 gig in size. So this is me actually provisioning a file share ready from our new clustered file server. And that's going to start provisioning. That's going to take a few minutes, but before I do that, before that finishes, let me quickly bring up one of my Hyper-V hosts and show you how easy it is to now assign that new storage to one of my hosts. Add file share. File share path, you'll see the Ben share hasn't quite finished provisioning yet, but I can use the dev one I created earlier and assign it to that Hyper-V host. So within just a few clicks, we've shown how to deploy a new clustered file server that's resilient, it's scalable, it's low cost, it's simple to manage using commodity hardware, commodity servers, JBOD disks, and we've made it resilient through the clustered file server. We've shown how we can extend capacity, and now we've shown how we make that available to the Hyper-V hosts. And VMM takes care of everything. The ACLing of the shares to the actual Hyper-V hosts, everything is done by VMM in one place. So it really streamlines the whole management experience of storage. And back to you.
Fantastic, Matt. Think about what you just saw there. He just provisioned from bare metal a scale-out file server. Now keep in mind that VMM already has the capability to provision your Hyper-V compute nodes from bare metal. So now I could literally roll in a rack of servers, go to VMM, provision all of my Hyper-V servers. It'll, from bare metal, deploy Windows Server, enable Hyper-V, configure the cluster, etc. I can then scale out my file server, create my scale-out file server from scratch, and do all of that without ever touching my racks. All of that from VMM. Tremendous. So I know Ben just talked about this, and I wanted to come back and kind of add a little bit of diagrams to what Ben was talking about. But it's the challenges of guest clustering. And one of the things that we found out in talking with enterprises and service providers especially is guest clustering is one of those things that, you know, you can kind of do in an enterprise. Service providers won't do it. And let me explain to you why. So there's a really important thing I want to point out, very crystal clear and very interesting about service providers. Note this red line. This red line is actually really important, okay? So I'm a service provider. I own everything below the red line. I focus on giving you my cloud infrastructure. I have servers, I have storage, I have networking. All I care about is giving you uptime and reducing my costs. And you know what? Maybe I want to change out a server. Maybe I want to put in some lower cost storage. Maybe I want to change out some NICs. And I want to be able to do whatever I want below the line. And you are all my customers. And I don't ever want you to see that. If I change out a server, if I change out storage, it should be all completely transparent to you. So as the infrastructure or the cloud service provider admin, I give you VMs, I give you storage, but the physical resources are opaque. You don't know what the server is I'm giving you. You just know that I'm giving you a virtual machine and I'm giving you X amount of storage. You don't know what the name brand of the server is. You don't even know what the type of storage is. Is it direct attach? Is it a file share? Is it iSCSI? Is it a SAN? You don't know. You just know you've been given storage. Now, enabling guest clustering requires creating a hole in the physical infrastructure. This is really important. Cloud service providers, that red line, that's super important to them. I am not breaking that red line. To me, this is the separation here. This is not happening. You don't get to see the physical hardware. But to enable guest clustering, it requires that I break open this hole and I actually expose a LUN, fiber channel, iSCSI. And because of that, cloud service providers won't offer guest clustering. And in fact, no one's happy. Because the customer may be running guest clustering on-premises, so they want to move up to the cloud, but if their cloud service provider says, sorry, I'm not letting you do guest clustering, I don't do that, I'm not exposing ALN to you, then you're not going to move it because you're not going to give up HA. So no one's happy. Customer that wants to move up to the service provider isn't going to get HA, so they can't move it up to the cloud. The service provider isn't happy because he can't provide the service. So what we really want to do is we want to solve this problem. And to do that, that's what guest clustering with shared VHDX is all about. With shared VHDX, what we're doing is we're giving you virtual disks that run on top of the line. So it's still a VHDX. It's still a file. It lives above the line. In this case, everybody is happy. Because as the service provider, I get to give you guest clustering. I get to give you highly available storage. And you know what? Yeah, I'm probably going to charge you a little bit more. That's okay. Because as you're used to paying more for HA, and you're willing to pay more, because that's a non-starter if I'm going to go to cloud and not have guest clustering. So everyone's happy. So this is actually a really difficult problem that we're solving in a very, very elegant way. I'm very excited about shared VHDX. So this provides a little context about that really awesome demo from Ben. So software-defined networking. So one of the interesting things about software-defined networking is for the last 18 months, 2 years, I've been listening to the industry talk about software-defined networking. And oh my gosh, it's the greatest thing ever, and it's going to solve all of these problems, and it's wonderful and magical. And when you talk to someone and you explain to them, okay, so why is it important to me? We've been giving you the wrong answer. Okay? I read all these articles and say, why is software-defined networking important? Because it breaks the VLAN scalability problem. And then we start talking in acronyms. We start talking about NVGRE or VX this or VX that or something here or something there, but you're not explaining why it's important. Let me do that now. This is why it's important. I'm going to go back to this slide that I presented earlier with a couple changes here. So again, our cloud OS vision, public, private, and service providers. This is why network virtualization is so important. This is why you have to have it for cloud. Because today I may be running on premises. Tomorrow I may decide I want to move it to Azure. Maybe I want to move some resources to my service provider. Maybe 2 years from now I want to move from my service provider to Azure or vice versa. Guess what? Network virtualization is what makes this work. You cannot do this without network virtualization. This is why it is so critical to cloud. In fact, I posit, I'm not sure you can do cloud without it. Because now I can take services and I can take my network with me to the cloud. I want to be able to take my network to Azure, take my network to my service provider, and it just looks like an extension of my data center. If you're telling me that, oh no, to move this workload to a service provider, I'm going to have to completely re-IP it, can change all of its network settings, that's just not happening. Customers will say, well, that was really a short conversation because I'm not going to do that. Now you can take your network with you. This is why network virtualization is so important. The other things it gives you, number one, it gives you network agility. It gives you the ability to take your network to the cloud. Number two, it eases management. Now there's a separation of the control plane and the data plane. Let me be very clear about this. We have everything for network virtualization right now. We've been shipping this in Windows Server and System Center 2012. Okay? Windows Server 2012 is the data plane. Network virtualization is already built in. It's built right into the Hyper-V switch. The control plane is System Center. System Center is how you create your logical networks, manage your logical networks. That's all handled in System Center. Live migration across subnets. This is the only way you can do this. By definition, traversing a subnet means a drop in connectivity, not with network virtualization. We can now live migrate across subnets. Yes, it does break the VLAN scalability. This is actually very important for cloud service providers, because technically, according to the VLAN spec, there's 4,095 VLANs. But in reality, most switches don't even go beyond 1,024. And if you're a cloud service provider and you've been assigning a VLAN to every different customer, guess what? You're going to run out real soon. Network virtualization, you're talking 16 million plus different networks available. And you can merge networks on the same fabric. So, for example, I've talked with customers that have done mergers and acquisitions. And I actually spoke with a dairy about a year and a half ago. And they said over the last couple of years, they've been merging with other dairies. So they had literally six different, you know, data centers they were trying to merge together. And the CTO was saying, look, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. I mean, do I need to bring in like a guy with a PhD in networking to try and rationalize all this? I said, no. I said, what you do is you virtualize all the networks, and they can actually run on the same physical fabric with the same physical NICs, the same physical switches, and still maintain all of that isolation. It's exactly what they're looking for. It solves so many problems. Well, in 2012 R2, what are we doing? We're taking this to the next level, because now we're including a multi-tenant gateway in the box. Before, we had partners doing this, and we still have partners. In fact, we have a lot of partners in terms of F5, Gateway, Huawei, Iron Mountain, Huawei, that are developing gateways and hardware. And we also want to make sure we're making it easy, so we're providing it in software as well. Also, self-service virtual network provisioning and management, and of course, standards-based automated network switch management. So as we've talked to you, and we've talked about deploying your compute, deploying your storage, now let's talk about network management. And for that, I'd like to invite Matt McSpirit back up again. And let's talk about network virtualization and network management.
Thank you. Right, we're back in Virtual Machine Manager. A really quick look at how we simplify the deployment of new network infrastructure using the in-box network virtualization. Now, we're in Virtual Machine Manager again. And this time we're looking at the networks, the VM networks specifically. And I've created a couple already, one for sales and one for marketing. But these could be two completely different customers. They could be red and blue, like Jeff had on his slide. But in this case, sales has got a 10.10 subnet, marketing's got a 172.16 subnet. And these are isolated VM networks running on a single physical network. And these are isolated using network virtualization. There's no VLANs, no reconfiguration of my switches and ports. Everything's done through VMM and through network virtualization. So let's quickly create a new network. So we'll go through the wizard, creating a VM network. And I'm going to create one for my dev team. And I'm going to choose my physical network it's going to run on, so my logical network being the naming of that. And we'll go next. And I choose my isolation. And this is me saying, okay, do I want to use network virtualization or do I not want to isolate at all? In this case, I'm obviously going to use network virtualization. And we support IPv4 and IPv6 as options there. We'll go next. I define the subnets that inside this VM network are going to be used by the virtual machines. And I can have a single or multiple subnets within this environment. And I'm going to choose 10.10.10.0/24. And you'll notice I've intentionally made that conflict and overlap with the sales VM network. And that's because I don't have to worry. Network virtualization is going to create this new dev network. It's going to be an isolated VM network, and my dev VMs are not going to conflict with my sales VMs, even though they are IP addressed identically. It just doesn't matter. They're completely isolated through network virtualization. Now, I don't want that to be the name, but it saves me typing it twice. And I'll type it devlan. There we go. So that's just me naming the subnet. Now, here's what Jeff was talking about a minute ago, this gateway. If I've got virtualized networks in my environment and VMs in there, those VMs, if they wanted to talk to Jeff's laptop, for instance, his laptop doesn't understand network virtualization. So we need a bridge between those devices that are perhaps unaware of network virtualization, or a device that allows us to communicate with VMs in virtualized networks in other data centers. That's where the gateway comes in. So I'm going to choose our gateway. I'm going to choose NAT. We're going to use the in-box, scalable, production-ready, multi-tenant gateway that we've got in 2012 R2. I'm going to go next. I configure some NAT settings if I needed to. Next, and finish. And within a few clicks, we've actually deployed a new network. It's just appeared in our list. I could then go ahead and deploy a new IP pool that could be used by the VMs within that environment. So not only are we deploying the network itself, but we're also choosing to deploy and manage the IP addresses that are given to virtual machines within that particular network. But before we do that, I want to show you very quickly how we scale out and we deploy these gateways more effectively. And we do that by providing you with a service template in the box that you can use to actually deploy these new gateways, so providing that bridge functionality from within VMM. So this is a service template. It's got the appropriate number of NICs to connect internal and external, or whatever the networks may be. And if we drill into the settings of this template, we'll see in the OS config settings for the template, it's got the admin password, the operating system information, and all of the roles and features that are required to turn this standard Windows Server 2012 R2 VM or OS into a new gateway OS that will provide the functionality we need to bridge those VM networks to the external world. So that was just a quick look at how easy it was to deploy new virtual networks and how we help you scale out with that gateway service template. So with that, back to you.
Thank you so much, Matt. So again, think about what you're seeing here. First of all, give it up for Matt. So again, let's review. VMM can deploy now your compute from bare metal, from a baseboard controller. I can deploy your scale-out file server. I can deploy your logical networks, your network virtualization, all from VMM. All of this, tremendous. And we have a huge ecosystem that's growing bigger and bigger around our network initiatives. When it comes to gateway appliances, we have F5, Iron Networks, and Huawei. We also have now, Arista has developed an OMI-based top-of-rack switch. Why is this important? Well, first of all, OMI is an open standard. In fact, we've made this open. In fact, we're embracing the Linux community. It's open source. And in fact, with Arista, now you can actually manage your top-of-rack switch from VMM. So now, not only are we managing your logical networks, but we can actually manage your top-of-rack switches as well. So that's very exciting. We have a whole bunch of partners for our Hyper-V switch extension. Cisco has shipped the Nexus 1000V. NEC has the programmable OpenFlow switch that's only available on Hyper-V. We have Five9 and Inmon delivering solutions for Hyper-V. In addition, we also have chipset extensions, Broadcom, Intel, Mellanox, Emulex, Brocade. What are they doing? Well, the NVGRE that we use for network virtualization, first of all, it's an industry standard. It's not a Microsoft proprietary thing. It's an industry standard. And now they're putting NVGRE acceleration into their chipsets. So we're very excited. That tells you just how popular and how much people believe in this whole concept of network virtualization and what we're doing in terms of networking. So finally, let's get to recovery services. As I mentioned before, we want to expand business continuity. You may have high-end DR systems or even business DR solutions today, but is it giving you all the coverage that you need? In fact, let me ask a quick question. How many of you have disaster recovery in place? Not too bad. How many of you would like to have disaster recovery in place? Okay, all right. We want to broaden even those folks that have already made the investment in high-end disaster recovery, synchronous replication, those types of things. Replica can still be used to expand that even further. And we also want to expand it even further and make changes and improvements to Replica based on your feedback. So, for example, the feedback we got from you, quite honestly, was, honestly, folks love it. Integrated VM replication in the box, it's all there with Hyper-V Replica. However, one thing we found out was our service providers had an interesting challenge. We told all of our service providers, look, you should be a Replica target. There are plenty of companies over here that don't have a second data center. And they would love to be able to replicate to a service provider. And a whole bunch of service providers said yes, except we don't want to have to buy a high-end replication system as well. And so we would like to be able to use Replica. And Replica only does one hop. So in 2012 R2, we are now introducing tertiary replication, which means now I can go from a customer to the service provider. And guess what? The service provider can also use replication to go to a secondary site of their own. So now we've made this even better for service providers. That's tertiary replication in the box. And then, of course, the other huge announcement, of course, is Hyper-V Recovery Manager. Hyper-V Recovery Manager is about giving you that centralized orchestration engine to manage your replication cross-site. I could be in Madrid, I could be Barcelona, I could be in Shanghai, I could be in New York. Doesn't matter. I want to be able to see all of my resources for either planned site migrations or disaster recovery capabilities. And giving me that one uniform way that plugs in the system center and manages my site-to-site replications and gives me that one view is extremely powerful. The other thing we heard loud and clear is our customers love the fact that Replica is easy. I mean, you literally walk through a wizard and you've created replication. They said, if you're going to give us multi-site, we want that bad, but keep it easy. If I have to install some really complex management, I have to set up a whole bunch of things to make it work, it's going to lose a bunch of the luster that Replica gives me. That's why we made it an Azure service. You don't need to install anything. It's actually already there waiting for you in the cloud. And again, it integrates with System Center on premises. So with that, I'd like to invite Michael Leeworthy to the stage, show off some of our business continuity. Michael.
Okay. So what I want to do is show you some of the things that Jeff talked about, especially starting with Hyper-V Replica, and then introducing our Hyper-V Recovery Manager solutions, going a little bit deeper into that than we saw this morning, because these are really exciting technologies that marry to each other. The HRM solution is utilizing Replica. So as Jeff said today, we've now introduced new technology into our Hyper-V Replica environment. And if you haven't seen Replica before, it's just super simple to set up from that single VM level and then utilize things such as System Center Orchestrator. You can actually orchestrate Replica solutions in your environment as well. So I can simply enable replication here through this wizard and walk me through a number of quick steps to allow me to do that, just that simple primary site to a replica site replication. So here I'm just going to enter the server in. I'm going to replicate to another server in my data center, or it could be a service provider. It's going to give me a choice of replication type, so I can actually authenticate via Kerberos. Since I'm doing internally, I'm utilizing Kerberos. But if I'm going to a service provider, I'm probably going to use a certificate that I have shared with them. I can choose which VHDs I actually replicate in this case. I'm not going to replicate my page file, just my primary system file. And then I'm going to have some other configurations as well. Now, the big thing here is, the new thing here is now we support three types of timing. So if you've got, very low latency links, you can utilize your 30-second timing and be able to have that near-time replication of your primary Hyper-V VM roles. Now, the big thing here also is now we support multiple ones as well. So if you've got links that are a little slower or a little dirty, you can now support up to, you can utilize our 15-minute links or the standard 5-minute links. So this gives you a choice of the way that you're going to replicate your VMs either across your organization or into your service provider and what type of replica you want to support. So I'm going to choose our 30 seconds. I can also define additional recovery points. So I can actually utilize snapshots or checkpoints, as we call them in R2, to actually go back in moments of time. So I can also, say, restore back from an hour or two or three or 4 hours ago. So say if you're a business and you're coming to the end of tax or something like that, you can actually snapshot that information back and then roll back at that certain time. I can also use the inbuilt VSS snapshot componentry as well to ensure that I have great application state replication. So I'm just going to go walk through the standard one. And our last choice here is how do I want to get the initial replica to that replica site? How do I want to do that at first copy of that information? Because that actually could be quite large. I'm doing a copy of that VHD file. So if it's internal, I can say, go for it now. I've got really great network bandwidth. Just go and copy that now. Or I could schedule it. Say, make sure it happens after business hours. Or in the case of a service provider, maybe I actually don't want to use my internet links here. I can actually just put it onto some sort of mobile media, send it to them. They deploy it in that first instance. And when we whip it up, we can do the initial replication and bring it up to state. So I've got those great choices out of the box. So I'm basically just going to kick that off, and it will replicate immediately. You can see that's been replicated across to my secondary site here. But as Jeff said, we've now extended this in 2012 R2. I can now do extended replication, all that tertiary replication as he talked about. So basically, I'm going to go down here, and I'm going to go extend this replication. It's going to walk me through a very similar wizard that I had before, so we'll just quickly go through that, where I'm just going to replicate to a third site here. Same authentication choices, but you can see here my replication is 5 minutes or 15 minutes. Where I had 30 seconds before, this gives me the ability to ensure that I have good stateful replicas across those primary site and the two replica sites as well. So you can see it's really simple to now deploy the initial replica and also this tertiary replica or extended replica in your organization. Now what I want to do now is just quickly show you how we can use this replication environment utilizing our new technology, Hyper-V Recovery Manager. And the great thing about Hyper-V Recovery Manager, even though it's an Azure-based agent, it is your data center. It's VMM. So effectively here I have my cloud and virtual machine manager running a number of virtual machines. And you can see here that if I bring up another view of VMM, these are my two virtual machine manager sites. And I'm utilizing Replica controlled by my HRM or my Azure service. I'm replicating my primary site to that secondary site. You can see here this Azure-based service gives me the ability to configure the replication, view the monitoring, view the health and the performance of those of my replication environment. So here I can see which items I'm protecting. In this case, I should be protecting around 13 or so virtual machines within my cloud. I can view both the primary site and the replica site and information associated with those. But I think the most exciting thing that we have within the HRM tool is the ability to do recovery plans, because you just don't want to fail your entire site over and actually have no rules associated with that. You know, if you've got 14 or 50 or 100 VMs and you want to do a site failover, you want to control exactly how those virtual machines come up. Maybe do some configuration, you know, in this case, before I actually do the failover, I want to do a PowerShell script to pre-initialize the environment. Maybe I need to do some integrated virtual networking, as Matt showed you before, utilizing PowerShell. I need to actually be able to configure that final site. And then I want to be able to bring up certain servers. So you can see here I'm bringing up this block of servers here. Once I've brought that up, I can bring this block of servers here. The great thing here with Virtual Machine Manager is that the HRM agent will be talking to VMM and ensuring that these servers are up, running, and responding before it moves to the next step. And then if I want to add other groups, I can quickly add other groups in this. And I can even do different actions, such as PowerShell scripts, virtual machines, or even a manual action. In this case, you know, maybe Bob needs to go and flick a switch or move a network cable to a different rack. I can actually put this as part of my recovery plan, and my recovery will pause and wait for that. So it's some really exciting technology. It's available as this Azure agent, utilizing your virtual machine manager in your environment, using that power of Replica and Windows Server 2012 R2. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Michael. So we're nearing the end here, and a couple things I just wanted to close with. I want to make sure everyone's very clear about something. When it comes to Microsoft workloads, let's be just 100% completely transparent about this. Microsoft workloads run best on Hyper-V. It is the most tested platform by far. On an average day, not week, not month, not year, day, just in the server division alone, we create and test over 25,000 VMs. We basically have our own private cloud internally, fires up 25,000. It usually can be as high as 35,000 VMs a day. We run a whole bunch of unit tests on them. At the end of the day, if there's any that had any problems, we pull them out so they can be triaged later. Next day, we fire them up again. Every single day, 500,000 a month. On top of that, it's part of our common engineering criteria. Every product, all of our features, all of our technologies, Hyper-V there is first, it's best, it's tested end to end. Integration and partnership within Windows Server. Look at some of the key new capabilities we introduced. In Server 2012, we introduced the ability to actually deploy domain controllers cloned using Hyper-V VMs. This is because we added some key new technologies like generation IDs. It's because we have that great partnership in the kernel with AD. We also have great partnerships with BitLocker, clustering, and now in 2012 R2, automatic VM activation. And also, Dynamics recommends Hyper-V for virtualization. Exchange recommends Hyper-V for virtualization. Link, SharePoint, SQL, you name it. And again, Windows Azure is 100% Hyper-V. We're talking literally hundreds of thousands of servers powering our global cloud are all running Server 2012 Hyper-V. It is the best supported platform running end-to-end supported platform end-to-end by Microsoft. So with that, I just want to say thank you very much. It's time to virtualize every workload. It's time to rethink storage. It's time to simplify networking, to expand business continuity, to deliver hybrid services, and this is a great way to do it. Enjoy the rest of your week here at TechEd. Thank you very, very much.